And there we go. So parallax scrolling, Rob. What about it and why is it hard? Rob Stenzinger of Art Geeks. Look what I did. Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com. What is this, 2011?
Exactly. You know, it's out there, right? Jersey Drozd of, wow, heck, how many projects do you have on the interwebs? I mean, and how many presences on the social networks, right? I mean, we always say comics are great. That's the flagship jersey. That's the flagship jersey.
That's the guest room.
Flying Fortress.
What do they call that? The entry room. What do they call that when you walk into a house and there's a place to hang your put your boots, hang your coat, and all that stuff?
It's the foyer.
Foyer. Yeah, there we go. That's my foyer. And that's where I keep my grimoire. Comicsaregreat.com. So parallax scrolling. Here's vocab moment, everybody. We're going to learn what parallax scrolling is.
So parallax scrolling is, what's funny is you just asked me before we hit record and you gave a excellent textbook definition. So I'm going to try to play that back. Is parallax scrolling is when you have multiple layers on things loaded into a scene on a screen, and those layers are moving at different speeds, and that those different speeds give you the impression of three dimensions.
An impression of depth. And you use Sonic the Hedgehog as your example.
Yeah, exactly. That was one of the, that isn't the first example of parallax scrolling. I was doing some reading on it. I have to look for this link or whatever, but not a Commodore VIC 20 game, but Commodore 64 game that was attributed as being the first one with parallax scrolling or what have you. It's a neat technique. And the reason I was working with that is it's part of this big set of examples that I'm working on for this probably a family of game development classes or workshops. I don't know.
It's turned into a full-on family.
I don't know. In some ways, that makes it smaller because, I mean, yeah, I've gone off on this crazy path of how did I phrase it to you before? It was like I was trying to do my magnum opus on game development, and it got kind of untenable but interesting. And you know, it's one of those things where I think what I built would play out fine over multiple weeks and making a syllabus out of it, not trying to brag like, oh, I made a college level course or something, but it's a lot harder to be simple.
Oh, heck yeah.
To prune things where for weeks and weeks, I just kept brain dumping and organizing and then doing some creative exercises. How could I present this and whatever? And came up with a game, you know, how do you making a game out of making a game and all this stuff. But anyway, whatever. And the latest instance of that is I've got some pruned down ideas that might be sort of an interesting separate ways of looking at this, where you could take one and have a sample and be satisfied. You don't need to take the big epic quest. Anyway.
Well, you've got 2 hours at Kids Read Comics. You got 1 hour on Saturday, one on Sunday. And I've already got you on the schedule.
Awesome.
Let's see where we got you. What? Did I take you off there? I got to put you back on Sunday. I had you on Sunday too. Maybe I relented. Maybe I was thinking like, I don't want to abuse Rob.
No, I'm happy. I'm traveling out there. I didn't, I'm not getting, you know, getting dressed up in my Dragon Ball Z shirt for nothing.
4 to 5 PM on Saturday. And I'll be darned. I moved your workshop on Sunday and I need to add it back on. Get this. And this is totally, we're talking about like Art Week right now. And we may wind up talking about Art Week for quite a bit. I'm just warning people, 27 events happening on Saturday at kidsreadcomics.org.
That is super cool. I'm really stoked about getting out to Ann Arbor, Michigan for what July is it? The
7th and 8th.
7th and 8th, okay.
July 7th and 8th, actually the 6th, 7th and 8th, if you want to count the evening of the 6th when we have our kickoff event with Neil Kaplan, who's going to do a voice acting presentation / workshop at the Ann Arbor District Library. But yeah, you know, anybody who's been listening to anything I've been doing for any amount of time, although there's new listeners all the time, you've probably heard me talk at least a little bit about Kids Read Comics, this event that is our fourth year doing it. It's a free event, free to the public, free tables for artists, and all we ask in return is that the artists lead hands-on participatory workshops for us all weekend long. And man, we've got a boatload on Saturday, and more are coming in.
That is awesome.
And it's a really wide variety of stuff this year. Really wide. I'm astonished. We got like a animation workshop, digital drawing workshop, possibly I'm investigating an Adobe Illustrator workshop, how to draw an Adobe Illustrator.
Nice.
Webcomics panel, gaming presentation, gaming workshop with Rob Stenzinger, and then also professional development workshops, mini comics, how to draw workshops. Yeah. A lot of neat stuff. I don't want to tease it too hard. I don't want to be that guy. But yeah, in the next week or so, probably by the time this episode is live, the programming schedule will be up. So.
When? In a week from now?
Well, a week from the time we record this. This is going to go up Friday, right, cool, after this coming Friday.
Right? Yeah. All right, cool.
We got a little bit of a buffer in place now. So, Ravage. My cat's going crazy. She's so excited about Kids Read Comics. No, but anyway, I didn't want to turn into an ad for that. But that's one of the things I was working on this week, was the last 2 days. Man, you know, a couple episodes ago, we were talking about spreadsheeting. I went from, you know, nose to the grind, deadlining a book, a comic story, freelance gig, right into spreadsheeting. You know, organizing, trying to come up with a useful spreadsheet that also serves as a visual map for what events are happening, where, color coding it so people can get it like at a glance, like, oh, this is where I need to be at this time kind of thing. Different kind of creativity involved there. But it was challenging, but it was rewarding as I'm seeing it come together.
Super cool. Was there any particular visualization that you found helpful, and was it about sort of organizing over time, or was it about prioritizing, or both? Or
both. It really boiled down to, for me, was fitting it all on a screen. When you're dealing with a series of cells that are marked down to the half hour, so it goes 10 a.m., 10:30 a.m., 11 a.m., 11:30 a.m., 12 p.m., all the way to 6:30 p.m. That's a lot of fields. And then let me count on my Saturday spreadsheet how many different venues we got here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 different rooms where there's stuff going on. So to get that to where you can look at it all at once was the challenge. And what I opted for was a vertical linear time. So starting from the top at 10 a.m., scrolling down to the bottom at 6:30 p.m., scrolling left to right for the different venues. And then color coding the various events so that we can say, okay, well, this is a full hands-on workshop. This is a demonstration. This is an artist-only event. This is a little kids event, et cetera. And then assigning them also to particular people who are going to be sort of the logistics person, administrator of those different events.
Awesome. Well, I don't want to hog the ball as far as the, you know, the opportunity for others to get out there and speak and share their knowledge and whatnot. But if you need me for even three, I'm happy to do it. Cause I also have Turning Jokes into Comics.
I was going to ask. Well, and there's room, yeah. Rob. I mean, they took the reins off me this year.
Oh no.
They did.
Unbridled Jersey.
Well, you know, it's always been, It's always a this is totally, nobody cares about this kind of stuff, but it's always a difficult balance to try to measure, okay, how much programming can this thing sustain? You know, I don't know how many people are going to show up. This is a new venue. Every year it's a different venue, and that's why I want to stay in Ann Arbor from now on, because it'd be nice to, you know, stick with one place for a while so we have a sense of who's coming every year. Mm-hmm. But it's always a challenge to figure out, okay, how much audience is coming and how much programming can be sustained by X amount of audience, right? And one of the things that came out of our different developmental discussions with KRC this year is that, you know what? It's A-okay if we have some niche workshops that only speak to 10 of the kids there. We don't need to have 60 kids in every room. If 10 kids get exactly the experience they want, that's a good thing. And so I felt like, oh, finally the doors are blown off the car and I can do whatever I want. And I can have, you know, we got a workshop where, you know, I won't say who, but one of our guests wants to bring a snake and do a workshop on drawing animals like in the wild kind of thing. And I was like, cool, you know, that sounds interesting.
That is super cool. Yeah, because you're studying something that's moving and whatnot. That's a that's a different art challenge than something that's totally still.
It's not a poisonous snake, everybody. She's not bringing a boa constrictor to the thing. Well, boa constrictors aren't poisonous, are they? They're just strong.
They squeeze stuff.
Yeah, it's nothing like that. It's some smaller snake. But anyway, but yeah, so, you know, the doors have been blown off. I've been told by, you know, the powers that be that I can fill this thing up to the brim or to the rim or whatever. So if you want to do three events over the course of the weekend, Rob, my only concern, see, this is another concern I have to balance as an event organizer, and then I promise I will shut up about this, is that I don't want to fill up too much of any of the guest schedules with programs, because then you got to break for lunch, you got to watch your table, you know, and if you're doing 3 hours of programming in what is essentially like a 6-hour day on Sunday, you know, boy, that's half your day that you spent doing programming instead of getting to do the sales and talking with other artists and et cetera. Those conventions go by fast when you have a good time.
They do. Oh yeah, they do.
When you have a bad time, not so much. but when you're having a good time, which people do have at Kids Read Comics, then yeah, it goes by quick. So anyway, we'll talk.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, as far as, let's see, well, what the heck, I mean, as far as the two other angles, as far as making that game class a little more palatable, a little more swallowable than the giant multi-week horse pill that I had before, it was, we will consider tacking on a story to an existing simple game. And that's like one workshop, and then seeing how that changes the game. So we'll tweak it, and it'll be a lot about how a lot of times where you'll facilitate in front of a class is just I'm turning that in, you know, instead of a person drawing on the board, and the whole class is you're becoming the collective pen for everyone's thoughts.
Yeah, and hand over my hand to your brains. Yeah,
exactly. So I'll be doing that for integrating code examples into some result, and then having some little game aspects to it, but not the crazy, huge, epic thing that I had before, which still might live, but it'll probably be in a, yeah, like a Lean Into Art workshop, multiple weeks.
Awesome. So there's going to be plenty of material that you can mine for a variety of uses.
Yeah, and then the other one, so if you start out with a game and add a story to it, but then the other flip side of that would be starting with a simple story and then making a game out of it, right? And so finding the fun loop and then turning that into a game loop, and what kind of... And it would be a limited vocabulary thing. It wouldn't be like, oh, now we'll start coding some, you know, 3D over the shoulder perspective, what have you. It's going to be very, you know, a close relative of the...
Man, there's so many parallels between what you're talking about and what I deal with in a comics class, where when I try to get kids to back off and think fundamentals, and when I say fundamentals, I don't mean the Joe Kubert school. I'm starting to qualify.
Gotta stop doing that. Throw it down.
I'm throwing it. I'm getting rid of it. I'm putting it in the trash. It's crumpled up.
The gauntlet. the no disclaimer gauntlet. Wham! It's
no
thrown.
Disclaimers. But when I try to get them to focus on fundamentals, because like kids come to this class and they think that they're just gonna like learn to draw like their favorite manga master, right? Oh, I'm gonna draw like my favorite manga ka after taking this class. And when they see that, like I go when I'm up there going like, no, let's focus on, we're gonna do an exercise where we just play with shape. Like, oh, whatever, you know, and I'm not trying to be that guy. I'm not trying to be that teacher who's just trying to make class boring. But what I'm trying to get them to do is to think more fundamentally about story and how images interact with story, right? Mm-hmm. And then they can learn that other stuff down the road. Let's break off all this. And I've told the story before about the student who, you know, is like, I got to make it perfect. Got to make it perfect. No, you don't. I'm going to break this. I'm going to break you of this. You know, you are not going to be worried about making it perfect. You're going to start drawing sloppily and you're going to love it, you know.
And it's a really cool situation, honestly, where everyone's in a little bit of a discomfort zone, which is creating a lot of possibility, and to discover new stuff, which can be
that's your job to detect that too. That's your job as the teacher to detect those possibilities and grab onto them when they present themselves.
Yeah,
you know, I had a breakthrough moment with my class last week where somebody was doodling on the board the words "time hobos" and was drawing hobos, which I guess is not as edgy of a term anymore. I guess. And I was having this discussion with some people recently. I guess hobo isn't quite as aggressive of a word as it once was. Because the kids thought it was just hysterical, you know, time traveling hobos. And so rather than do the whole, all right, come on over here and you're going to get back to work, I took the moment to say, well, this is clearly entertaining the whole room. They're loving this. Let's talk about it a second. And so I just started asking some leading questions in a playful manner, not being the teacher, but going like, well, where the heck, how would time hobos work? You know, I mean, how does that work? I mean, because they don't have a time machine, they're hobos. And they're like, oh, well, they would jump on time trains. There's like a time rail network moving throughout the galaxy, and they jump on the boxcars. And there'd be a time authority who'd be chasing down the hobos for being, you know, on a vagrancy charge. I'm like, oh, that's funny, you know, and we're playing along and we're building the story, just joking around. It's the kind of thing you do when you're joking around with pals, right? You know what else would be cool? That's all writing is most of the time. You know what else would be cool? Mm-hmm. And then finding the point. And then I said, well, would these time hobos be able to visit different eras then, like past, present, future? Like, oh, yeah, and then the future would be, there'd be different future nexus points where it'd be like a conjunction of different eras. So you'd have Victorian people with dinosaurs, with space cars. I'm like, oh, that sounds awesome. Boy, I'd love to see what this stuff looks like. And they start drawing all these different places. And I see that some of these kids are focusing on the architecture. Some of these other kids are focusing on costumes. Some of these other kids are focusing on the characters. And I said, boy, I'd love to see this as a comic. But too bad that we can't, you know, make this as a comic. Oh, well, I could do the backgrounds. I could do the characters. And so suddenly they all started taking charge over what periods they were going to do. Like, oh, I want to do Victorian. I want to do prehistoric. I want to do, you know, hellish, future apocalypse. And I was like, can you guys do that? You can't do that. Oh, yeah, we can. You know, now they're defying me, right? And I'm totally being Alan Thicke on Growing Pains about this, right? I'm challenging them to do the thing by saying that no, it can't be done and all that. But next thing I know, the kids are taking this challenge and they're all working together. And they assigned a secretary to take all the notes while they're hashing out the story. And we'll see this week when I go to my next class that time hobos might become some kind of a mini comic that the whole group works on.
That super rocks.
I was pretty happy because that class was kind of hard to get those kids to participate in anything. But that one, they were all excited about.
I don't know if that class normally posts things on the internet or what have you. But
no, they don't.
At least I have encountered the creative concept of time hobos, and I'll have to be satisfied with that.
Well, if they get it done, I mean, if they finish the book or at least a few pages of it, then I'll be happy to share what they did. But yeah, it's just a matter of, there were a couple kids who already had like the train station sketched out and they were promising to go home and work on it in Blender. And they were talking about doing a lot of the architecture in Blender and then putting the drawn characters over top of these Blender backgrounds. So yeah, they were excited about it, which was cool. But that whole story was just to sort of show this whole idea that, you know, when you're teaching, that's your job, is to look for those moments. And when you're writing a story, it's kind of the same discipline. You're looking for those moments while you're writing.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to participate. I find myself needing to, I like switch gears. You know, it's like when I'm in a meeting where I go back and forth between I'm trying to creatively capture and synthesize, and then once in a while I'll try to instigate, and there are two different modes. Yeah. And or if you need to sort of test the thesis, and is everyone on this page or are we somewhere else? And then getting that whole definition to start to get shared and whatnot. But yeah, it's interesting where, for me, I end up, it's very deliberate shifting of gears.
Yeah.
And hopping back and forth between one and the other. Seems like for you, I don't know, seeing you work, it seems like, you know, you've got that a little more naturally or something.
See, I knew you were headed there, and this is the funny thing. I was going to try to knit this into a segue. Because that breakthrough moment came after 3 or 4 weeks of failing continuously, of going to class every week and feeling like, man, I can't get these kids to sign on. I've got a couple kids who are really interested in this class, but a third to two thirds of the room is just not cooperating with me. And I tried a whole bunch of tricks in my quiver. You know, I pulled out an old lesson that usually wins them over, which is let's watch a crummy old cartoon, crummy in quotes, because it's one of my favorite shows. So I just get the pleasure of watching one of my favorite old shows. But to the kids, it's old, it's boring, it's dumb. It doesn't have swears. These are teenagers. They want something that's edgy, you know. And when you're watching something sweet like He-Man from 1983, oh, it's so lame. And they usually brutalize it. But that's part of the fun for them, is they get to make fun of this old thing. And then I say, yeah, the designs were really bad, weren't they? Let's redesign 3 characters. You know, usually that's a gimme. That's an easy one where it's easy to get the whole room on my side. But man, there was a couple kids who just did not want to play. So it was I can't remember if it was 3 or 4 weeks, but it was a significant amount of time where I felt like I'm not getting anywhere with this. I am failing miserably at my job with this particular class. Again, couple kids, great, but, you know, I don't have the whole room like I'm used to. So when I had that breakthrough, it was awesome. It felt great. But, you know, that was a reminder to me that sometimes a project or a situation or a job or a creative endeavor of any kind, it takes time to find your footing in a changing environment. You know, every class I teach is a different group of kids. Usually there's a couple carryovers. There's a couple of 3-4 kids who like will take the class 3-4 times in a row, maybe a couple of years in a row. But there's always this influx of new kids. And so there's a new dynamic every time. And, you know, I've conditioned myself to say it's okay if I don't figure it out right away. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. It's I know a lot of people have different relationships with failure and how you look at that. Like even the idea, like sometimes of publishing a draft of something, I'll run into teams or situations that it's not really encouraged. Mm-hmm. Like the first thing has to be the finished thing no matter what. And for me, it's like I'm really into the idea of, all right, this represents the best expression of my current understanding that I got. And that's all I got right now, but I know it may not be adequate. But you know what? There's time to adjust. So let's get this out. Let's talk about it. And through that discussion and critique and whatever comes out of it, guess what? Now my Kung Fu is stronger and I will come back more likely able to defeat the creative challenge.
Do you think that's why people are hesitant to talk about failure? Because the performance is the demonstration of your expertise and you're talking about something that's a little bit more insubstantial. It's ethereal. It's you're talking about like building up your Kung Fu over a period of time and like marking that progress in your mind. Whereas that's not the thing that's demonstrated. The thing that's demonstrated is whether or not you got the colored belt this time. Right.
Sure. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, yeah, thinking about that too. I mean, heck, back when I years ago when I was studying Taekwondo, I did not pass every belt test the first time. And there you go. It's not an analogy anymore. It's actually literally, obviously it's crossing martial art terminology, but it is saying, well, my Kung Fu wasn't strong enough that day and have to go back and figure it out and analyze it. Let's see. I'm the way you started to reflect back at what we were talking about, I had a little inkling that maybe there's different kinds of like what you observe as far as what there's the result and how you're looking at it. Like, oh, I'm doing this thing and it's this task and people either liked it or they didn't. They accepted it and it's approved or it's not.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And and if it's sort of just an all or nothing instance. But for me, I mean, I guess I'm willing to accept that, but I typically think an all or nothing instance is arrived at by many smaller, not all or nothing instances.
Yeah.
So
explain what that means. Cause that's,
you
kind
have
of an
abstract
idea.
Chance to, yeah, no problem. There's room to talk about what you're making and share and express it and figure it out. So for instance, working on a webcomic and doing it publicly, and you notice when people are reacting to things, whether it was jokes or whether it's a new technique that you're using to produce the artwork, where you're like, oh yeah, I added this more texture to my coloring because I created two more steps in how I whatever shade things or what have you, and people are digging it. Or you just doing something different and seeing the reaction to the different thing. I mean, and I would say that's a creative act that is really well suited toward small steps and changes and adjustments in between steps.
Mm.
Or if you're working on a team, perhaps in a creative agency, doing some website design or whatever, that you can take what you're working on and then wander over to a coworker and get some critique, which is different than saying, well, here now it's published publicly, or here it's in the client's hands or whatever. You can take steps before that big final moment. In other words, and I don't know, did that go in the more tangible route that you were looking for?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, what I was driving at, I mean, and I think you addressed this in a way, and you also drove me even to another place where I think it's worth sort of like, you know, banging against this idea.
Mm.
Is there's the performance, there's the thing that can be measured, there's the thing that people are made aware of, and there's, in man, oh man, you know, fail blog, right? Which is old news now, but there's that kind of culture of thumbs up, thumbs down, right?
Ah, yeah.
YouTube has thumbs up, thumbs down buttons. And so it's not, the work that goes into something is not apparent. And you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be. What I'm saying is that Ravage, my cat is going crazy. Sorry, she's distracting me. She's intentionally trying to lead me off course here. But then you talk about like getting critiques or you getting feedback from people. That also can be misleading, and they can lead you astray of, you know, staying in your center or whatever, right? Because it's like, what percentage of people interact with your stuff? A very small percentage of people interact with your stuff. And are you going to change it or go in a different direction because like one guy or one gal said something nice about it or something bad about it, right? So you got to measure that. And so like, let's go back to my earlier example, because this is, you know, it's hot on my mind, is this classroom where I had a couple kids who were just being really resistant. They weren't being obnoxious. They weren't being mean to me or anything, but they were just being, they didn't act like they didn't really care. This was their social hour and it really wasn't time for, they weren't interested in drawing. They were interested in being around their pals, which I could take as a personal affront if I really wanted to. It's like, whoa, hey, how come you're not digging the dynamic personality of Jersey Drozd? After all, I'm an amazing teacher and you know, you're missing out or something like that. No, you know, I've since learned after many failures and getting upset about that kind of stuff that it's not about me, it's about them, and they're just self-absorbed teenagers. And how do you work with that, right?
Yeah.
And then I also remembered that, you know, you don't know what's sticking in these kids' heads when you're talking. They may not seem like they're paying attention, but stuff sticks sometimes. And I've had students come back to me years later and say, it's like that one time when you said this really smart thing to me, and they say something that sounds really smart. And I'm like, I don't remember saying that, but they clearly, it made an impression on them. And I thought that kid wasn't paying attention in my classroom, you know, that kind of thing. So there's little ethereal moments that can have its own kind of gravity that you don't even, you know, it's like these are analogs for any creative project. Is that little thing that I did, that little sketch that I did, that panel that I did, all of these are their own. You can go down to the microscopic level, to the quantum level on any of these things and call them victories or failures if you want to. You see what I'm saying? And
yeah, you remind me of a dialogue. Please finish your thought. Yeah.
Well, and I'm just saying that this is independent of any feedback you get. Yes, it feels great when you have that breakthrough and you feel like, and the audience gives you the applause. The kids are all signed on. They're all excited about something. But what was really successful, or what I feel the big success of that classroom moment I described, was I didn't get to take credit for it. That wasn't me saying, I've got a great idea. You kids are going to love this. And the kids went, oh, really? Tell me more. And then I start spelling it out to them. Like, oh, this is great, Mr. Joe's. You're wonderful. It was a situation where I disappeared and I let them take control of the situation and it became their thing. I was the facilitator. They're going to remember that classroom experience probably years from now and say, oh, I took this really great class and there was this guy who was kind of goofy, kind of ugly. What was his name? I don't remember, but it was an awesome class. And I learned this really great thing in this class, right? So I got that applause moment in the sense of the satisfaction of watching the kids be excited about something that I helped instigate. Mm-hmm. But what's important, I feel stupid saying this, but what's important is that recognizing that it took a lot of false starts to get there and finding my footing was the interesting part.
Well, it's a, the situation you presented has a lot of, it'd be really easy to just say, you could overly emphasize the whole, you supposedly had nothing to do with that. Right. Yeah. Take too little credit for what occurred, because mm-hmm. you are being a facilitator, and so you're picking and choosing where to intervene and where to stand back,
yeah,
and what to share and what not to share, and because it's happening naturally, it's not as let's see, I'm trying to think. Well, what would be a good I mean, it's like you're tending a garden more than punishing a tree into becoming a bonsai.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's like, yeah, I'm not saying, darn you, oak, how come you're not a weeping willow?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Letting it be what it wants to be, but then helping it get what it needs to turn into the thing it wants to be. Yeah. It's very Zen, but you know, it's like, I think here's another example that maybe we can lead us into more talking about this failure stuff is that, so you brought up, on one of our special Lean Into Art warm-up shows, which is only available to people who sign up for classes, a little hint for a plug there, that you kind of missed the Thunder Punch Daily Show. And I yeah. kind of, we spent a good half hour talking about why I haven't done one in a while. I haven't given up on it. It's just a lot of events and things I've been thinking about converged to make me say, you know what, I can't do it right now. For a lot of reasons, it's I can't do it right now. I want to do it. I'm going to get back to it. But a lot of things conspired to make me not do it, which is, I get to do that. It's my show. And I don't make any money off it. So, but one of the reasons that I hadn't been doing it is because this freelance project, which I was posting updates of online, I was trying out so many new things with it that I felt like I was thrusted back into the role of the learner again. This wasn't me exercising any well-oiled, fine-tuned musculature. This wasn't me doing something that came effortlessly where it's like, oh, I've done this dance 100 times. I can just jump right into it. This was me figuring out a lot of stuff on the fly while trying to meet a deadline. And while I was failing at it, because I did miss my deadline on it, I came in late on that job. Thankfully, the client was awesome about it and was really understanding and relaxed and said, that's no problem. We can give you another couple weeks. Et cetera, et cetera. But the fact is that in a lot of different ways, I was failing because I was learning as I was going. And I was talking with a friend of mine about this particular job, and he was noticing how haggard I I was looking. And I said to him, I said, well, you know, I'm making this job a lot harder than it has to be because I remember talking with some guys I know who I'm friends with who worked on the He-Man insert comics that come with the, that came with the action figures in 1982, right? So you got the He-Man figure, open up the package, there's a comic in there. I know some guys who worked on those books. Exciting thing. You know how much I love He-Man. And yeah. So I'm talking to these guys and I'm saying, man, you know, those comics were so awesome. It's so cool. I mean, it must be amazing to you 30 years from now to see grown men still talking about that work. And these guys shrug and they say, well, you know, it was a job. We were just kind of, we were just hacking it in because it was just a job. And it kind of broke my heart a little bit because it's like, it meant so much to me that, you know, I wanted to hear them say that, yeah, I poured my guts into that thing. I knew that that was going to affect you guys that way. You know, you want that experience. So my takeaway was this, is I said, well, here I am working on a comic that's going to be given to fourth graders, third graders. It's a comic that's made specifically for them. The characters are invented for them. It's really emphasized that these are their characters. That's a profound thing to give to a 7 or 8 year old, right? So I'm going to kill myself in this thing. I'm going to put everything I got to make this the best book that I personally can make. I'm telling this to my friend. He says, he's like, that's funny that that was your takeaway. And this is where a lot of listeners are going to, they're probably screaming at the headphones right now because they've been saying what he's about to say. He said that my takeaway would be is that they just hacked it in and you got a lot out of that. So the takeaway is that you don't have to put in much effort to please a 7-year-old. And I thought, well, that is one way of looking at it. But for better or worse, this is the way I'm looking at it. And I got to finish it this way. But I was trying out new digital painting techniques. I was inking in Manga Studio for the first time on a full comics project, entirely in Manga Studio, even doing like the backgrounds all in Manga Studio. So I was forced into this place where there was a lot of times where it was like, that didn't turn out right. I got to completely redo that. That is not working. Oh my gosh, this is a mess. How am I going to fix this? I've got a deadline looming over me and I'm failing and I missed my deadline and I failed on that. Where was I going with all this? This whole idea of not looking at failure as the pass or fail binary on-off switch of you either did it right or you didn't, but looking at failure as being an old saying, right, is it's a necessary step towards wisdom. And so when I finished the book, I felt really good about it. I felt very proud of the book. It had its weaker points. But overall, I'm really happy with it, and I got like a boatload of knowledge that I'm going to be able to take to other creative projects now. And I'm going to chronicle the learning experiences that I had on the Thunder Punch Daily Show. But
awesome.
But the big one for me was that it was refreshing to be thrusted back into that place of utter discomfort. I've talked about this in the past that like unless. Like, I know I'm on the right track when I feel a little nervous or panicked or scared of what I'm about to do. You know, like when I did that Ignite talk, I don't remember, like a year ago or whatever, and I was about to go out on stage and I'm like, what am I doing? You know, I got no right to do this. And I thought, no, that's the right feeling. You know, when you have that feeling, that means it's time to press on because you're about to do something kind of cool. Or you're going to fall on your face and make an idiot out of yourself, at which point you have a great story, you know, learning from Ryan Estrada.
Oh, sure.
So, you know,
you wake up in Korea.
You wake up on a park bench in a typhoon and you go, what? but it's, the failure thing as being a place of reassurance that, oh, I'm doing something interesting now because I'm screwing it up. You know, does that make any sense?
Makes a lot of sense, especially as it relates to having fun. It's been a few episodes since I mentioned the book Theory of Fun and or Flow. Both of those books. Theory of Fun, written by Rafe Koster. Should really find out how to pronounce his last name. And I can really tell he's taken a lot of things from Chris Crawford. Theory on Game Design, and also Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, however you pronounce Mihaly's last name. And anyway, Flow, as far as when you're engaging in a given task, is it interesting to you? And is it, are you tapping into things you're good at to, and effectively executing on that? So if you are, let's say you're drawing a comics page, is something you're, it's really in your comfort zone, but you're doing something with it that's pushing that your the difficulty level where it's not, you're not sitting in the slam dunk, this is easy for me zone. It's toward the edge of where you're comfortable, yep, and sometimes past.
Yep.
And if you get that tuning right, you are probably going to enjoy it. And there's good, and there's theories out there that back that up as far as game design theory and theory of like personal capability, effectiveness stuff. I don't know how to summarize Mihaly's work, but
well, I think you're also talking about if, like, you are generally speaking, if you have an optimistic viewpoint, right?
Mm.
Gosh, I just,
yeah. I mean, it's self. It's a, there's a lot of feedback in on itself because it's sort of so you've experienced, you've built up confidence. Likely, you have built up like confidence muscles because you've pushed yourself and you've not died or anything from that. And you've probably become even more effective at that thing that you were already enjoying, and now you can push yourself a little bit farther. And that whole thing is a it's likely going to lead to having a positive outlook on that thing. But of course, positive outlook feeds into willingness to take that kind of thing on too. Which it's been a couple of years since I've listened to Flo. So,
do you think that a positive outlook is something that can be nurtured, or you think it's something that's just ingrained in people, nature nurture?
I'm gonna cop out and say it's both.
Yeah, I don't know myself.
And that's my take on it. I'm not a psychologist, so.
But it's funny that it's one of those things where a lot of people who get quoted on the internet, people with stupid helpy tips, get quoted with this a lot. Like, you know, it's like fail early, fail often, fail big, and all that stuff. Yeah. But very few people can talk about failure. And I say few, I'm not saying nobody, but few people can talk about failure in a way that is reflective and useful. It usually easily devolves into, oh, nuts, you know.
I don't know if you're setting up a softball for me, because I want to swing at this thing you're saying and take a leap at there's a couple things that I failed at pretty recently,
yeah,
that I haven't really shared. I haven't shared publicly, and I haven't even taken the time, because I'm pushing myself in other areas, to really unbox it and contemplate much on it. I mean, I've thought about it a little bit. I'm not saying like, oh, this is totally, you know, Geraldo's vault of failure or Al Capone's, whatever.
Geraldo's vault of failure is pretty good. that's up there with what is it? KF'd, the radio station of all of your failures or whatever. Have you heard that one? That one gets passed around a lot. It's like they tell you, like, don't listen to KF'd because, and it's actually, you know, it's KFU something or other. It's like, don't listen to that because that just talks you out of doing interesting things, because all you're doing is replaying all of your failures over and over again.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So, like, totally. Yeah. Okay. So I'm thinking, if you're anything like me, when you experience a failure, you immediately get reflective, pensive, you know, quiet, going as you start to try to pull apart that Lego tower, going, what happened here?
Exactly. I get really curious, what happened here, and what does this mean? Like, what do I want to do with this going forward? And a lot of times, if I have some frustration about something, that'll make me quiet, because I'm not like frustrated internet guy. I typically like to say, oh, I'm saying something, and it's probably, you know, it's genuinely expressive, or it's serving something in a way that I can get behind. And I don't know, maybe one of these days I'm going to challenge myself, just because I like to do that. and have some kind of grumpy presence. I mean, I don't know, not to just steal a move from you again, but you've got your the evil jersey, right?
Oh yeah.
That is
my catharsis. Yeah. That's how I get a lot of that out of me, is through that little persona. But that's not aimed at anybody in particular. It's not.
Yeah. There's a certain curation to it that doesn't quite fit the whatever. Anyway.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing that I do play with. I'm like, I wonder if I could try that. What would that be like? But I get quiet with that. And along those lines, I went, well, okay, oops, these two things didn't work out. Boy, I've got a lot of other stuff to think about right now. So, haven't worried about it. Yep. So there's two different sort of talks that I worked on. And I made one of them I pretty much wrote the talk. And then the other one I went not darn close to rewriting the talk also as an outline. I did a proposal for something that was in the Pecha Kucha format for Games Learning Society, which that's a mighty close relative to the Ignite format, which I also submitted a talk for Ignite, which Ignite Minneapolis. And both of them rejected, both of them this year. And both of them, I thought, hey, this is pretty fun, pretty interesting. So the Games Learning Society one is a talk called Rime of the Ancient Game Developer. And it was meant to be both entertaining and analytical and,
I'm just going to shut it off if you do that again.
Yep. Okay. I don't want to risk that. Okay. So, all right. Rime of the Ancient Game Developer. It was also meant to be inspirational, essentially to entertain and have a positive feeling about it, to say, if you persevere and find ways to ironically, with what we're talking about right here, it is about looking at failures and roadblocks and questioning and persevering while you're questioning. That's it in a nutshell, because it's essentially the story of how I created Guitar Fretter, which is essentially me breaking like 16 years of, you brought up on the last Lean Into Art, where someone who may be, or something. It recently you mentioned encountering people who have a long-term relationship with not finishing something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, in some way, and when it came, and for me, the boundary has to do with when I was, if I'm getting paid for something or not. And if I wasn't, then I could always find a way there where it wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
And I'm past that now, but it still is interesting for me to look back and analyze. And I made a whole story of it, and I love the band Iron Maiden, and I love the song Rime of the Ancient Mariner. So I actually themed the whole presentation based on that. And I did like 20 slide doodles and submitted that with the talk and all that. And anyway, got rejected. I got some feedback. Well, actually two pieces of feedback. One of them really didn't like it, and the other one totally loved it. So that's extra not informative.
Yeah, really.
It's informative. Okay. Now, I want to go all over. Cause when I think about these things, even when I just said that, oh, that's not informative, because you have the extremely pleased person on one hand and then the definitely not impressed person on the other hand.
Yeah.
And I could easily say, oh, that nullifies. And honestly, to me, I don't think it does. Because if I question a little bit more the voice as far as what was behind the feedback, I realize that I'm really hitting one audience and completely chafing another audience.
Yeah.
And you know what? There's a lot of valid entertainment and things that come from that realm, right? I mean, it's not like Red Fox's, blue humor is going to please every audience.
Precisely, yeah.
And so honestly, from that failure, I realized, oh, I am hitting a nerve here with this story, and I could try to figure out how do I hit it even harder, right? Yep. I would prefer to do that than to try to nullify it and make it appeal to everybody.
That great, great, great point. And I'm getting a little bit of slap back from you, Rob. And while you adjust, I'll tell my story. So, same experience. I did a talk at, or rather a two-day workshop at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, right? Big deal. I was very proud of myself for being asked to do it. And I went through a lot of work to get to go to do this thing. There was a lot of preparations. I won't go into all the details, but it was a 6 to 8 month process of developing all my materials to be able to do this 2 day event. And I really felt like a gravity, you know, like when you walk into that place, the place is built for giants, you know, like many of the monuments in Washington and the buildings in Washington are built for 40 foot tall people. So you walk into that place and it's like, holy cow, you know? Anyway.
Cool. Zentradi, right? I suppose.
Yeah. yes. And I was the micronized Bron walking in there. So I did my thing and, you know, they gave me reviews. Like all the teachers got to fill out an evaluation form. And there were some teachers, and these were teachers who were, you know, teachers are in a really hard place right now in standards-based education, No Child Left Behind, open court reading programs, and, you know, got to stick to this curriculum, and we only got so much budget, so much time, et cetera, et cetera. And here I am saying, hey, you should teach comics on top of all this other stuff, you know. Although I worked very hard to knit my content to say, well, no, you could just take your lesson on Charlotte's Web and just add this to it to speak to these different kinds of reading modalities, so on.
Mm-hmm.
Two teachers show up, and they were kindergarten and first grade teachers, even though the workshop description said for grades 3 through 5 teachers. But they saw comics and said fun and, you know, we'll come along. When I presented them with the notion of, oh, we're all going to draw today, they crossed their arms and said, oh no, we're not drawing. And they said it like that. We're not drawing. You're not making us do it. And I poured on every ounce of my, if you want to call it, charm to get them to engage and to do the thing. Ah, you just stick figures, blah, blah, blah. They were pissed. They were angry with me for challenging them in this way. And then so when they did the evaluation form, they said, this does not apply to my classroom. This is not at all applicable to what I'm teaching. And B, you didn't tell me that there was going to be any drawing in this, right? Some of the other teachers, you know, high marks. Oh, this was really great. It was so inspiring. I can't wait to apply this stuff in my classroom. So same thing, very diametrically opposed feedback. And, you know, I like you, I considered the source and said, okay, well, these people, they weren't my audience. They weren't even supposed to be here. And, you know, it's like I've faced this before with school teachers who haven't drawn in 20 years. It's tough. It's a tough sell, right? Totally understand. So comes time to do the second round, to apply to do the same workshop again the next year. And, you know, that those two teachers who said those things, it came back to me that, you know, let's see if we can do this comics workshop without any drawing in it. To which I was like, what? How can you do a comics workshop without drawing? And I tried to make my case. I said, well, you know, it may be difficult or dangerous for the teachers to engage with drawing, but their kids are going to be craving to draw. So they need to do this in order to experience what the kids are going to experience. And I was explaining how, like, when the teachers model this activity, the kids don't know that they can't draw. They just see drawings happening. To the kids, it's magic, you know? So I know I can diminish this risk. Well, no, we really think that you need to do it without drawing. And I talked to some of my other teaching friends, and they're like, don't do it. Don't compromise your workshop. This workshop is great. It's just not for that audience. The Kennedy Center is great, but it's just not your audience. I was like, I want that prestige. I want to do it again, and I want to turn this into a recurring gig. It's a good paying gig, and maybe I can leverage this to do some kind of national touring kind of thing, et cetera, et cetera. All right, well, I'm gonna redo the entire thing so there's no drawing. And I did it. I turned it in, and I worked with them a lot to try to rejigger this thing to make those two people happy. I got turned down anyway. And that one hurt. That felt like a crash and burn. It's like I did all these things to try to make this reach more people, and it crashed and burned anyway. And at the time, I remember distinctly feeling like, man, I failed. This was a golden opportunity. I wasn't smart enough. I didn't know what I was doing. Who was I to play with giants, you know? In retrospect, and I said this before we started recording, if I could go back in time, I would say to myself, you know, like, dude, don't worry. that wasn't your audience. You know, it's cool. You had your chance. You got to do a thing. You got to touch a few lives. Walk away. and you learned a little bit about the fight that you're up against if you want to do this if you want to take this advocacy thing seriously, is that there are institutions and people who are part of a system that, and I don't want to make this into some kind of fight in the man thing. Ooh, I just did one of those qualifications. There's people in a system. There's people,
yellow card.
Yeah, yellow card. 5 minutes in the box. But these people are part of a system that is there, and it's going to be a tough act, or it's going to be a tough work to break through that and make them realize that you're their friend, you know. And if you can't, you can't. You've clearly reached some people with the things that you have been doing. Keep working on that. It's cool. But so there was a failure, there was a learning experience, and all that crap. But the funny thing is that in your case, this is a situation where you have the ability to reflect and say, I clearly struck a nerve here. Let's just move in that direction rather than say, this guy was really mad. How do I get this guy to like me? You know, the best way to defeat your enemy is to make him your friend and all that.
Oh, sure. And I'm into that as well. I like that idea, and I like being hyper inclusive and allowing ideas to sort of build up and crumble under their own weight. When, like, let's say you're working at in a collaborative session at work and doing whiteboarding, and someone's really wandering off in a direction that maybe isn't reinforcing or honing an existing important path, but they're sort of needing to self-express or whatever. You know, I try to give people just honor it all, not worry about it. Yeah. But at the same time, when I'm thinking about where am I going to apply my time in my life, I know that, well, that's a finite resource, and I can't, I know that there's people out there that won't want to connect with me, and I know that, and I accept that.
Yeah.
And so what I want to do is find that natural amplification of finding a community that wants to connect with me.
Sure. Going back to your coat of arms.
Exactly. And it's, you know, that was hard earned and through pain of experience and trying to make something out of that experience that is a healthy systemic approach. And it's not black and white, what have you. And I'm kind of disclaiming right now, but screw it. All right. Okay. So learning from that failure was, I set out to get a speaking gig and I didn't get it. Right. But.
So I guess you weren't immediately good at it. So don't do it, Rob. That's the takeaway.
What's ironic is that's one of the things that fueled me to then try the Ignite submission that then got rejected. And that one was funny too, because I was all full of beans and fired up when I wrote that thing, and was kind of on a I was in one of those writing zones where perhaps I was all full of it and full of beans, but in my own cloud of stink and unable to see past it. I know, sorry for playing that analogy out, but whatever.
No, you're talking about something I wrestle with all the time, dude. Is that I. You know, it's like okay, here's the advice that gets hammered at us is that follow your star, do what feels right to you, do what feels natural, listen to your inner voice. You know when you're at the center, and just keep going there, keep sailing, and you'll get to that place where you belong and whatever. And like, well, what if the place where I belong is an island of me? Right? It's like there's an Andy Kindler joke. I found out who my audience is, guys who are my age, who are me, you know? And like, what if... What if that's it, right? It's like I keep that comic I did for that freelance gig. I am so happy with it, Rob. I am so happy with it. There was a line of dialogue where I got a little thrill of goosebumps when I wrote it. I was like, I was really struggling with the line. I had like a crude version in the thumbnails, and I thought, I'll fix that later. And when I got it and I wrote the line, it was so reminiscent of the cartoons that I grew up on and what I think makes them great. The stuff that I really can't talk about with a whole lot of people without boring them to tears, you know, and that's not a qualification. This is the truth. When I go on these jags, I watch people turn away. Like I've got some kind of syndrome that makes me unaware of how people are interacting with me, and they're all going someplace else and I'm still going on this thing. You know, I've seen it happen. I know this for a fact that this is not something that is of interest to a lot of people, but it's really interesting to me. And I wrote that line. I was like, oh, this is so good. And I'm so proud of it. I can't share this with anybody because nobody cares about this like I care about this, because I'm my ship is sailing towards the island of me. You know, it's like that's something that, you know, it could be when you're making something that you're full of beans on, that you're sitting in your own stink and you're not even aware that you're the only person who really cares about this thing. I don't have an answer for that. I don't have like a way to cope with that except, you know, laugh grimly, like the same way you laugh at like death. You know, it's like slapstick. One minute you're alive, one minute you're dead. And all you can do is laugh in that situation.
Yeah, exactly. Because yeah, what else can you do that, right, that keeps you sane and positive? I think that for me, again, this can be self-deluding. I understand. Because obviously you run into these situations. You have, so setting forth on a quest, there's a, you know, I have a goal. I want to land this gig and I'm going to, you know, express this idea about it. And I'm really happy with what I expressed. And then to get just, it was a mildly encouraging rejection. But it really wasn't filled with feedback either. And then so then how do you get more information? I'm like, well, how do I get context for this? And I went and looked at, well, what things were approved. So this, the approved list of things show the curating voice of those that are managing the event and may represent, like, so they had some tough trade-offs, or they had duplicates of topic, or they, you know, you put yourself in their shoes, in other words, and think, well, what did they have to filter through? Yeah. And even with that in mind, I'm like, ah, you know, I think I had an audience mismatch again. But at the same time, even a further mismatch than that initial attempt too, because the Games Learning Society conference would definitely have people that are hands-on, having a tough time wrestling with this, that probably want to hear an example of coming through that fine. But then others that are thinking more from the representing the most current interesting academic theories on what motivates people and visualization of data and whatever, whatever they're looking for based on that. And I'm not reinforcing that because, well, I didn't even go to college. So,
so let's see if I can summarize this in a stupid healthy tip. The truth lies somewhere between, it's their loss and you need to try harder.
Yep.
You know, okay, I'm going to try to wrap a closing thought around this thing if I can. The reason I think this topic is so interesting is, man, I wrestle with this a lot, Rob. And here's what we can talk about, you know, like a sense of being attentive to failure, or at least that attention to trying to figure out what works for you. I've made no secret out of the fact that I walk a line between wanting to share stuff that's helpful to people or that's somewhat useful to people, without crossing that line into, here's the five tips to do such and such. Here's your five surefire successful ways to do such. The things that you see in all the blogs, right? We've made fun of this a million times, the guru mentality. And you know what? What's funny is I feel, now that I've sort of like, kind of feel like I've got a little bit of a handle on how I feel about this, I'm feeling a lot less anxiety and irritation with the guru, because I feel like it's that moment in Labyrinth when Sarah says to Jareth, you have no power over me. Oh, You don't. It's okay. I figured this out now. The guru talks about strategies to be successful. Talking about failure is sort of sharing your particular viewpoint on how you struggled with a thing that everybody struggles with. So it's not giving advice. It's saying, I'm sharing an experience. You've probably had an experience like this too. Here's how I kind of tried to make sense out of it. And because of the fact that I'm talking about failure, there's an automatic built-in disclaimer in the sense that I failed. This might be a failure too, but here's the thing that I figured it out as best I can at this particular point in time.
Sure. It's more of a, it's a demonstration that has a lot of personal voice in it and not in the sense of, it has a exploratory voice to it and not an authoritative voice.
Yep. It's a non-artificial way of saying I'm down here with you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of what we try to have as part of our message with Lean Into Art. We're working on getting better at doing things, but I think we're doing a lot of really valid things that we are serving people and people do pay for them and whatnot. But at the same time, it's not in our interests to present that as this unassailable wall of perfection that you always have to look up and listen to whoever's shouting down from up on that wall.
Right. Well, and see, by couching it with just even the topic of failure, we've bypassed even having to say any of that disclaimy stuff, right? So I'm just wondering, here's what I'm thinking right now, is that we should have a, I don't want to do that. Nope, never mind. I've already changed my mind.
What was your bad idea?
Okay, well, here's my bad idea, is that I was going to say, like, we should have, like, a failure of the week kind of thing. Like, you know, like, people have the tip of the week. Here's my tip of the week. Here's the thing to fix your, here's the thing I screwed up on this week. I hate the idea of a public confession too. Totally Orwellian, Animal Farm, the animals line up and there's the dog sitting there bristling and then Napoleon the pig stand there presiding and everybody's confessing because the terror of not confessing is greater than the terror of those dog's jaws being wrapped around you, you know. Oh. So.
Yeah, that's pretty bleak. We're working on it. So we're trying to iterate on this idea as we're talking about it. Because to me, it's more of a learning experience. And it reminds me of, well, the first business I formed and a lot of the dialogues that I would have with the group of friends that that formed that business with me, right? So the first, and I know that we're probably wrapping up quick. Maybe this is a topic for another time. But the idea of, it was a game development company called Basement Brothers Enterprises, and it led to most all of us involved getting jobs in the IT industry and different software development and creative things and whatever. But on the way, we worked on a game and we didn't finish it. And when we talk about it, different members of the group would express it as a failure. This was a fail. And boy, would that get my goat. Oh, back in the day, I mean, it just, you wanted to see some righteous wrath. I mean, and not in like, I'm going to, you know, wrestle or, you know, throw a rock or something, but it just in the ready to just debate.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to go on too much of a tangent here, but there is a certain pride in dismissing what didn't amount to the public performance of success, right? I totally fell victim to that stuff when I was younger, like when I was in my 20s, and I would talk to Tom Root. This is like when we were really kicking into high gear with some of our Antarctic Press projects, and there was a project that I shared online, actually. It was a pitch that we did. Let's see if I can find it. I'll write it down for the show notes. It's called Stranger Things, and I think I posted it on Google+. But it was a 22-page comic that I did as a pitch for Antarctic Press, and I got a lot of feedback on it saying, like, oh, the script's brilliant, the concept's really great, but man, that Droz guy, he's got to straighten up. I mean, his stuff is weak. And I got really mad, and I changed gears, and it's a long story, but I'll save everybody that. But I remember years later when I started feeling like, oh, I'm starting to figure out this comic stuff. It's starting to make sense to me, and I feel like I'm getting a command over certain things. And I feel like I know what my voice is a little bit. And Tom would bring up Stranger Things, like, boy, I'd love to do Stranger Things again. I'm like, oh, God, I can't even look at that art. It's so bad. And Tom would say to me, he's like, you know, every time you say that, it's like a knife in my heart because I thought it was pretty good for the time, you know. But there's that pride in dismissing the thing that you didn't finish or for whatever reason, polite society would look down upon it because it didn't do the big thing on TV that everybody talks about, right?
Gotcha. Yeah. So it's a little bit of a scarred pride kind of thing and talking about it. And
I don't know if this was what your friends were going through, but I'm just saying that it reminds me of that.
No, it's interesting. I mean, since we have had a lot more interesting conversations of it, you know, I suppose getting older and having a little less testosterone and whatnot.
I've been taking my estrogen pills. How about you? That would surprise no one, actually.
So you get a whole bunch more until you turn into a ball of it, and then you just go into the force or something?
Yeah. Exactly. You need to watch Kung Fu Panda. You just, like, evaporate with, like, peach tree leaves. That's what the Master Turtle did at the end.
Nice. I bet that was a good scent.
Yeah, it probably smelled very pretty. Probably fresh. Would aggravate my allergies nowadays.
Mm.
Another thing to look forward to as you get old. Anyway, hey, Rob, I think this was a good conversation. I feel good about it. You know, here's my learning experience.
No way, we failed.
Well, I did fail at not qualifying my statements.
Me too.
It's harder than I thought, man. This stuff, it's like a drug.
It is. I used to have so many habits with that. Doing a lot of business writing and presenting and whatnot. And it just, it's a habit I picked up.
Yeah, me too. So it's going to be a while to shake it off. And that was the big takeaway this time, is I thought, like, I was going to this one, like, fired up, like, oh, this is going to be our best episode ever, because it's going to be the first time when I say things unapologetically. I'll do better next time.
That was pretty good. It was pretty unapologetic. Still a little apologetic.
We'll know we've done it when some guy emails us to say, excuse me, sir, you know, when we get that, that's when you've done it.
Yep.
And it's not to say that you have to tick people off. I'm just saying that it's an inevitable consequence of expressing an opinion with any kind of sense of earnest zeal, that somebody's going to come along and say, excuse me, sir. Every time I ever did that when I was on the Art and Story podcast, that's when I would get the excuse me, sir email. So it's coming.
I look forward to it.
I look forward to not reading it.
Exactly. I look forward to adding that filter.
No. I don't know. We'll see. All right. Anyway. Okay. Hey, guess what, everybody? Thanks for downloading and listening. And if you thought this conversation was worth your time and worth the time of other people, if you think, gosh, I can't be the only person who feels this way, I can't be on a boat cruising to an island of me, other people need to hear these stupid helpy tips. Well, there's a great way you could help us out, is if you go to iTunes and do a search for Rob Stenzinger or Jersey Dross, or lean into art and give us a star review on iTunes. That's the number one way to introduce the show to more people, because that's where people go to look for the things that they're interested in. So, you know, we don't have a whole lot of ratings on there. I did check after all, and I was like, hey, we're better than that. So you could help the show out a lot by giving us just a star review. You don't even have to write anything, and it's totally anonymous as far as I can tell. So, don't have to make a public spectacle out of it. Don't have to harangue anybody on Twitter. So we would appreciate that a lot.
Yes, definitely.
So, hey, Rob, I guess I'll see you next week, huh?
Yeah, definitely. Let's do this again.
All right. We'll give it another whack. And until then, I have been Jersey Drozd of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I've been Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.